We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Feel like Kobe in the fourth quarter.
This is the Dane Moore NBA podcast brought to you by Blue Wire Podcast. Britt Robson of The Athletic coming in here in a second. We just recorded. Our presenting sponsor today is BetUS, a place for you to wager on the games with the NBA finals here. At BetUS, they've got great payouts, the industry's biggest bonuses, and every bet type you can think of. You can join now by calling 1-800-69-BETUS or online at BetUS.com. Get 125% sign-up bonus using the promo code DANE125 at BetUS. You bet, you win, you get paid. On today's show, Britt and I will get into that terrific game four of the NBA Finals. And in the second half of the episode, maybe like a half hour in, we get into where we're seeing in these playoffs and what we're seeing in these playoffs and in these finals that can kind of be applied with a Wolves lens, kind of looking at what Ant and maybe D'Lo can fill in ways similar to guys like Middleton and Booker for Phoenix and Milwaukee. We also talk about how the offseason in Summer League is right around the corner and the NBA just doesn't stop. And then Britt goes on to tell a fantastic story about getting hammered with George Karl at Summer League 30 years ago. So enjoy it. Here's Britt. All right. Britt Robson of The Athletic, again, joining me here on Thursday morning, the morning after the Milwaukee Bucks brought the NBA Finals back to 2-2, a 40-point performance. Chris Middleton, 42-point performance. Devin Booker, maybe a little tired, but pretty effective. 26-point performance from Giannis Antetokounmpo. Obviously, we'll talk about that block. Then on the negative side of things, Jrue Holiday shot 4 of 20 from the field. And Chris Paul somehow only had 10 points and 5 turnovers in the game. Britt, which of those players, or where do you want to start with this?
Well, I think that, as I tweeted out last night, I think it really dramatized in the modern game where you are emphasizing mid-range a little bit more, but you're just emphasizing jump shots in general.
Yeah.
And the threat of what I really want to say is you need a magnetizer who can get buckets in a crucible, who can get buckets when the pressure is on. And if you miss the bucket, probably your chances of winning drop from like 55 to 38 or something, you know, that kind of pressure. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the Bucks and Suns both have that kind of player. And certainly you could argue that they're not necessarily the best player on their team in either case. Some would argue that Booker's better than Chris Paul anyway, but certainly Middleton is not better than Giannis. But when it comes to those moments, when you're having a close, you know, hard-fought game, for all the spectacular role players, the Jay Crowders, the P.J. Tuckers, the Pat Connaughtons, you know, the Cam Johnsons, they're all cool. I mean, it helps make the game so much fun. But at the end of the day, does Devin Booker get a bucket? Does Chris Middleton get a bucket? You know, really almost is the difference.
That defined it, right?
Yeah.
I think what's interesting with that is it's like, there is this fine line, though, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I was listening to Zach Lowe this morning talk about it. And I think he said 53% of Phoenix's shots
right.
were mid-range shots.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, I think we're all at this point where we're like, we could throw out the idea that mid-range shots are quote unquote bad shots to take. Like that is,
well, especially in that, the playoffs where defense is so good.
Exactly. And particularly the way that teams are defending now. But at the same time, if it becomes so much your bread and butter, then it is just a math game, right? Because what do we normally say? Like over 50%, maybe 55%. If you're hitting those from the mid-range area, you know, then it is it's for sure like a good shot. But at the same time, right? Like a 55% mid-range shot, that's 1.1 points per shot, right? Like I'm doing the quick math here. That's well less than a 40% three-point shot. So they're just, it is important and it's so necessary, particularly given the coverages that in the NBA are now opening up that area so more. And it's just harder with locked in defenses to get easy layups and open threes, but you can overdo it. And I don't think Devin Booker necessarily overdid it, but the other shots that Phoenix might've been taking in the game a little bit, got you there.
I think that, a lot of it has to do with your personnel and your identity. Now, with the Suns, I can't verify this, but I imagine they took more three-pointers than the Bucks took as many or more three-pointers than the Suns during the regular season, didn't they?
I would say the Bucks would have taken more during the regular season.
But the Suns, you know, obviously have 3-point specialists, you know.
True.
And they have that in their game. I think the strategy would have been a lot less flawed if Chris Paul was hitting his mid-range. You know, if Chris Paul wasn't, I make fun of Woj a lot because he makes his living as a gossip monger, but he basically said something at halftime and at the game last night where he said, you know, is Chris Paul being worn down by Drew Holiday? And I thought that was a really good insight because Drew Holiday is a physical beast on the perimeter. He's like Kawhi in his prime in that way, in terms of just casually using his body and the threat of pressure as well as the pressure all the time, that it's both mentally and physically exhausting to play somebody like him. And, you know, Chris Paul is no spring chicken and has all ton of pressure on him to finally get this last step in this journey. And I think he was just flat out fatigued last night. And I wonder, you know, there are fortunately for the Suns anyway, some long rests between games now. So that, you know, you'll be able to, you know, see what happens. But I do wonder about that. And I think that if, back to your point, if Chris Paul is making that mid-range and getting open for that mid-range, creating space, I don't think the Suns' preponderance of mid-range hurts them as much. Let's face it, nobody was making shots really except for Booker on a regular basis.
To the Holiday point, because I do think it has to be a two-sided conversation. We can appropriately assign blame for his shot-making being poor, taking too many, missing too many shots.
You mean Holiday also, himself on mid-range?
Just shots in general.
Yeah, no, I was talking about his impact on Paul, or wearing down Paul.
Yeah, that's okay, what I'm saying. Okay, it's two parts.
Yeah.
So offensively, he's struggling. I mean, for the series, it's 36% from two, 27% from three. Last night was ridiculous.
20 shots. And you know he's not making them. I mean, and some of those shots.
That like one with like a minute and a half left in the game and he pulled up from 15 feet. You're like, that is not going in.
He does not have to do that. You know, it's weird with the Bucks.
But you're stopping me from giving him praise. Okay, I wanted to give him praise.
All right.
Because Woj is right. You're right. Like part of Chris Paul having that bad of a game was Drew Holiday. And this is really random, but you know, it's one of the advantages or benefits of watching random league pass games. And I remember last year when Holiday was in New Orleans and New Orleans had a bunch of injuries and I think Zion wasn't playing. Maybe like Derek Favors was their big, and they're playing the Cleveland Cavaliers and Kevin Love was playing really well. And the Pelicans had nobody to guard him with. So they just, that was like the first quarter. I don't know. Love probably had like 12, 14 points. So they go the next three quarters with Drew Holiday on Kevin Love. And a lot of Love's points he was getting was on the perimeter. And so Holiday goes, all right, I'm just going to get up in your shorts like you're a point guard. And he starts taking away his ability to you know, to get any sort of pick and pop threes or whatever. So Love in his head goes, all right, I'm going to take this 6 foot four dude into the post.
Right.
And just try and go to work on him. And Drew Holiday, he kept Love, you know how Love gets kind of frustrated.
Right.
And Love tried to keep going at it. And it was like five or six times in a row where Holiday like ripped him in the post or just kept him off of his spot completely. And I think that we do acknowledge that Drew Holiday is a good player, but Drew Holiday is, sometimes we only call versatile defenders guys who are like 6'9". Drew Holiday is one of the most versatile defenders in the NBA, even though he's 6'4".
Amen.
His force as a defender is so valuable, and it's why it was so shocking to me that they didn't put him on Chris Paul in game one. Remember, they had P.J. Tucker there. Because they're worried about the role game,
right?
Because they knew they were going to switch everything, and they're worried about Ayton, you know,
right?
And they were like, "Oh, Tucker will be able to guard Ayton on the role." Well, not. I remember I kept watching that and thinking about the silly Pelicans game a year ago. And I'm like, I don't know. I feel like Drew Holiday can hold his own on the post against DeAndre Ayton as well as PJ Tucker can. Plus, he's a better defender at the point against Chris Paul. I mean, he's incredible defensively. Awful offensively. It's a bizarre balance.
And I'm really glad you talked about versatility, because the Bucks have two players like that, and one could argue even three players like that. Giannis can guard the point or the center. I mean, so you have a guy who's like
seven. And often guards neither of them. Often is right. Off of the corner.
Right, right. But I mean, so he can guard anybody. Holiday can kind of guard anybody. And the secret weapon last night was Connaughton. I mean,
man,
what's crazy about Connaughton is, you know, and Budenholzer gets all kinds of shit, and some of it is deserved, plus the fact he, you know, gives Vanilla a spicy nickname, you know? I mean, he's so bad at what he does in terms of presenting himself. But he stuck with that switch that Phoenix kept on wanting to do of having Connaughton trapped underneath, and Connaughton defended well enough for the help to come a lot of the time and got the rebound a lot. He had 9 rebounds. He has, per 36 minutes, he was third on the Bucks in rebounding this year.
Really?
Portis and Giannis were the only two ahead of him. He was better there per 36. You know, obviously he didn't play as many minutes. He had more rebounds than Lopez, had more rebounds than Tucker. The guy is just, he's a feisty little fire hydrant, you know? And so.
Well, how about the way he was guarding Booker too? I mean, Booker was making tough shots on him in those situations.
Booker, I mean, that's a whole separate conversation. I mean, you know, Booker, I've got all kinds of respect for Booker because, I mean, he threw most of that respect. I tweeted about how he was mentally tough and, you know, he understood that the refs weren't going to call anything. And then he started going apeshit over all the calls. So, you know, I mean, you know, but
there were some bad calls.
How dare he make me look bad? But I mean, it's just, but you're right. It was the worst officiated games of the playoffs, I thought. I mean, first of all, they allowed Booker's 6th and 7th fouls. I mean, just.
Yeah, but even like rewind before that. Where there's that play where
Booker's
it actually went off
a
Tucker's
wasn't
foot.
A foul, right?
Yeah, I mean it was
and then
messy
and then Tucker's fifth foul wasn't a foul. That was a Crowder flop. By the way, as a longtime Jay Crowder fan, what a douchebag. I mean, you know, oh my goodness. Can you believe how much he keeps flopping and wincing? The guy's gotten poked in the eye 8 times and nobody else gets poked in the eye. How does that happen? You know,
I have
where he's like
here.
Face down on the court.
I have a note here as I'm showing you on my thing that says Crowder antics for profit and then Crowder antics for profit again. I mean, it was that the Connaughton one. I would have lost my mind if I was Connaughton on him, where he like came where Crowder was coming up to set the screen and Crowder just like it worked.
He threw himself into the other side of the court.
Crowder does seem to get actually hit in the face a lot, though.
Yeah, well, I understand the impulse after watching him for a while. I mean, I have a good friend of mine who's a Clippers fan who just, you know, Just
do you have any friends who like good teams?
Now, I actually think the Clippers, you know, have played the Bucks tougher than anybody else.
Well,
I mean, played
yes.
the.
I meant historically.
Yeah,
historically.
Right.
My buddy, who's a Kings fan.
Right.
Although, half my friends are Timberwolves fans.
Yeah. But on the other hand, you know, they've just underachieved on being, hey, they fulfill your edict of having a passel of star players. According to your formula, that's usually all it takes.
Hey. I wasn't into the Clippers this year.
No.
Only guy I liked on that team was Batum.
Batum was great. I agree. I mean, he was. I love guys that are, you know, the reinventions, you know.
Right.
But anyway, right. Back to your point about, I think it was mid-range and long-range shooting way back when. I do think that taking away Aiden as well as they did the last two games has been huge. And totally. I think it has gotten to the point now where it's like when you've been on a smooth highway for 50 miles and all of a sudden you take a turn and it's not that rough of a highway, but it's a rough road. And all of a sudden you go, you know, you're not used to it. Aiden is not used to not succeeding in these playoffs. And this is his first playoffs and he's gotten all kinds of credit for it. And now it's really crunch time. I mean, he's got a challenge right now. He's glorious on the boards. He had 5 assists last night. He's playing the right way. He's just, his shot isn't, you know, that pick and roll isn't there right now as easily as it was all the other games. And some of that is Paul, as we mentioned, but some of that is the way they're defending him. And I really think he's an X factor. He is the guy. If Aiden has a good game, more likely than not, they are going to win. I mean, if he gets like 20 points and 15 rebounds, it's over for the other team.
It's interesting, and this does kind of tie into the mid-range shooting, because a mid-range shot is a two-point shot, right?
Right.
And the Suns last night shot 33 of 55 from two. That's insanely good.
At 60%.
With Ayton only going 3 of 9. So right. They're well over 60% without Ayton.
And that was typically Booker. All those shots we were just talking about, the Connaughton, Giannis, you know, everybody in his face. You know, Booker, the look on Booker's face at the end of game 3, he kind of had the same look, to be honest with you, at the end of game 4, but at least he had 40 points versus 10. When he was sitting on the bench during garbage time of game 3, it just looked like he wanted to go, you know, break his hand on a wall someplace. And I thought he's going to have a great game 4 because he is somebody. I mean, that dude is going to be a postseason star for the rest of his career, I think. I do not doubt his ability to rise up for big games.
No, not at all. I mean, it's the Donovan Mitchell and Jamal Murray from last year, but even on a higher level and in more meaningful games.
I think he's a better passer than both of those guys.
Right, right. No, I don't mean that to be slanderous.
No.
Like,
right.
There's a archetype of player
exactly
who can explode in these type of situations and these type of games where shot creation, shot making is
paramount.
You know. Paramount. Yeah, that's the word. The thing I wanted to say with the 2-point I think this is just nuts. So Suns go 7 of 23 from 3. Bucks go 7 of 29 from 3. You know, about the same there.
Right.
Phoenix goes 33 of 55 from 2, and Milwaukee goes 32 of 68, and they win the game. So Milwaukee
rebounding. You tweeted it out. It was the offensive rebounds and the
five offensive rebounds for Phoenix, 17 turnovers for Phoenix, 17 offensive rebounds for Milwaukee, 5 turnovers from Milwaukee. The inverse right there. And sometimes these games we simplify with pointing to a stat or, you know, oh, how many fast.
That was a good one.
That one was the difference.
It's not exact math because sometimes a turnover and an offensive rebound can happen on the same possession, but that's roughly 24 extra possessions.
I know. They shot 13 extra twos and 6 extra threes.
So that's 18. So that's probably how many extra possessions they had, because the fouls were probably evened out. You know. So
right.
you know, that's enormous. When you know, when Chris Paul and DeAndre Ayton are not having good games, and you have that kind of disparity. Now, some of it obviously is contributed to that. Paul's turnovers clearly in that marker, but and the Suns stayed close anyway, and it was on the road. And you got to think there's a lot of reasons why the Suns will bounce back in a game five, because a lot went wrong for them, you know. But we'll see. Sometimes it's all momentum.
It's interesting, like, we could pretty much point to all of these games and we go, well, the Suns need to have two of Booker, Paul, and Ayton having big games for them to be able to work. And I think it's the same thing with the Bucks. You have to have two of Middleton, Holiday, Giannis to have a big game. And I was thinking about this, and it's just been kind of stuck in my head, particularly with Milwaukee for the past couple of rounds, where they have no bench. They have no bench. And I was thinking about, for both of these teams, if they had a Lou Williams type of player who could fill in for that for one of those games, like Phoenix last night, where they only had one of their three guys going, they have nobody who can have that out of nowhere, you know, 22 points off the bench type of game. And I know Cameron Payne did it like in one game in the conference finals, but you go through it and it's like, unless, I don't know, is Cam Johnson going to make like six threes for you? Like,
or, well, those are the guys, Crowder. Cam Johnson. And,
but those are a little bit different, right? Those are guys that need to be open.
Yeah, Cam Johnson and Payne, and then Connaughton and Portis would be the other guys on the other side.
But who of those guys are going to go out and get me 20?
Right. I would say that Connaughton and Payne are the guys who are closest to being able to do that on off their respective benches. But then if you got to regard, to some extent, I don't know if this is accurate. Certainly it seems like at the last two games, Connaughton has played more minutes than Brook Lopez, so you can't really call him a bench guy.
True.
He's kind of like a starting five guy. I mean, he's not starting, but he's, you know, he's getting a lot of minutes. So
I'm just continually baffled as I look at these box scores at the end of the games, and I see the three players that come in on the bench for the Bucks are Pat Connaughton, Bobby Portis, and Jeff Teague. And then the rest of the guys.
Well, Teague is a waste, obviously.
Well, Teague is a waste, but so are the rest of the guys on the team. Thanasis, Elijah Bryant, Mabdi Diakite, yeah. Bryn Forbes, Justin Jackson, Jordan Nwora, Axel Toupain. I mean, can anybody name where half those guys went to college? Like, it's
right.
It's a.
Did you mention David Nwaba in that?
No, I said
Patrick Nwaba or what?
No, Diakite. You love Nwaba, but he's on the Rockets.
I was just gonna say, wait a minute. Let's bring David Nwaba on the unsuspecting. All right.
He's your Caris LeVert.
Yeah, maybe. He's a poor man's Caris LeVert, that's for sure.
All right, let's take a quick break. The NBA finals are here, and this summer's betting action is heating up with my friends over at BetUS. Looking at some of the odds over at BetUS after game four, the Phoenix Suns have now dropped to only slight favorites in the series after that game four win by Milwaukee. The Suns are now minus 160 win the series, according to BetUS. I believe I said on here after game two that the Suns were all the way up at minus 480. So the series is definitely shifting, and if you want to bet on it, BetUS has a ton of different prop bets that you can hit. Also with the UFC, MLB golf, Summer Olympics, football season all just around the corner, you need a sports book. BetUS has the industry's biggest bonuses and every kind of bet type you could dream of. BetUS has been a pioneer in online betting for over 25 years, prides itself on being America's favorite sports book. So take advantage of this action-packed summer and sign up today at BetUS.com. That's BetUS.com or 1-800-69-BETUS. Receive a 125% sign-up bonus when you use the promo code Dane, my name, Dane125. If you miss tip-off, forget to bet, you can bet live at BetUS as well. And if you care for some blackjack, there are also hundreds of games in the BetUS casino. I bet at BetUS, and so should you. Join now by calling 1-800-69-BETUS or online at BetUS.com. BetUS, you bet, you win, you get paid. The best talent brings out the best in each other. If your company is looking for teammates to take you to the next level, you need Indeed. When hiring gets hard, you need Indeed, the job site that makes hiring incredibly simple. Just attract, interview, and hire. In fact, with Indeed, you can do all of your hiring in one place, even interviewing. Don't just hope your perfect candidate will find you. Indeed's hiring tools help you cut through the noise to hire faster and smarter. In fact, Indeed's Instant Match provides a list of quality candidates whose resumes are on Indeed the moment you post a sponsored job. Indeed Instant Match helps you make a short list of great candidates fast. The moment a sponsor shows up, you get a list of quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed match your job description. Then you can invite them to apply right then. Indeed helps you hire great people fast. Plus, Indeed takes finding quality candidates even faster with 135 assessments to help make sure you find applicants with the right skills. Best of all, you only pay for applicants who meet your must-have qualifications. According to Talent Nest, Indeed delivers four times more hires than all other job sites combined. Join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Get started right now with a $75 sponsored credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Get a $75 credit at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Indeed.com/BlueWire. Offer valid through September 30th. Terms and conditions apply. All right, Brett. So we've kind of hit on what happened in Game 4. What do you... In the second half of this, let's get into what happens the rest of the series, and then if we want to get into some other around the NBA or Wolves specific things too. But what are these next three games in your eyes?
Well, I've happily said from the beginning of the series I have no idea what's going to happen. I mean, I really don't.
You have effectively copped out every time we've talked.
Well, can you blame me? I mean, what are you anticipating here? I mean, you know, anything I say might be right, might be wrong. I will say that whenever I've just like thrown shit off the cuff, I've been more accurate than things I really believe. So maybe I ought to just say things off the cuff. What I can say is that sometime in the next two games, Giannis is going to dominate in their offense. He's going to get like, what Booker did last night will be Giannis. He will get 25 to 30 shots. And how great he is at doing that will make a huge difference. He should do it on the road because that's where they need it the most. Milwaukee's 9-1 at home in the playoffs. So where they need Giannis to be the best player on the court, and as a two-time MVP, he should be showing that, is on the road. So I would say that...
do you think they go to hack a Giannis on the road?
Yes. You know, in a moderate way. You know, I mean, part of it is Giannis does have now, you know, game three has given him some fortitude. And it the idea... I mean, if the NBA really wanted to screw with people now, just totally drive both fan bases nuts, they'd start to enforce that 10-second rule. And, you know, then things would just be berserk. But it doesn't look like they're going to. So
you covered that Timberwolves team that their strategy was against the Lakers in the playoffs to hack a Shaq. And they had, they have Irvin Johnson, Madsen.
Yeah.
Who was the third? Stanley Roberts or something. I don't know.
They threw at him. No. Let me see. Irvin Johnson was Ola Candy on that team. I think Candyman maybe.
No, this is when the Wolves were good.
Yeah, but I think he might have been a starter for a while that year.
What was it like asking like Flip about that in those
Flip times? Loves that kind of stuff. Yeah, Flip loves like wrinkles. If Flip can have a wrinkle, he's dying. If you don't ask him after like five or six questions, he'll volunteer it. You know,
really?
He used to love, you know, the zone defenses were outlawed when Flip was coaching. And so Flip would always slide in how we managed to evade the zone defense law and still play zone defense on some things. I mean, he just loves to tinker. He loved to tinker. He's I miss him now that I'm talking about it, just because he's so gleeful about basketball, you know, and all aspects of it. And the idea that he could have an impact on the game somehow was just, you know, that he was, the world was his oyster. If he could be talking about something he had done. He once told me, like, the most satisfying thing is to call a play out of a timeout and then just watch it work perfectly. I mean, he said that was, like, the most satisfying thing he could. Because I asked him, you know, you never played in the NBA as a coach. How do you compensate for that? You know, what are the greatest joys coaching? And that was the first thing he said. Calling a play out of a timeout and having it just happen right away.
My first place my head goes to there in modern NBA is Brad Stevens.
Although Stevens is – Flip was good, but, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, the game has evolved so much.
They both became president of basketball operations.
That's right. They did. Yeah, they both, although Flip always wanted to do both. He was, you know, even when he was coach, he, you know, basically would, he and McHale had an interesting friendly rivalry about what to do with the team a lot. So, but anyway, yeah, it's, I think Hack Giannis will happen.
Well, it's just, it so clearly impacts him more when he's on the road and everyone's
right
screaming at him, you know,
right.
Like that's it. It would totally be something. And what we've kind of seen the NBA move to in these situations is it's a way to almost slow the game down more than anything else.
Right.
Right. We saw the Hawks do that against Simmons when they were at a deficit.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I guess we're at a deficit or if you're at a profit, you know, if you're up by.
No, but if you were on a run.
Oh, no, up, you wouldn't want to. Yeah.
But if you were on a run closing in on another team's big lead, you're giving them a chance to think about the fact that if I make these shots, it will dent their run. If I don't make it, it's like a made shot for them in some way. You know, I mean, it enhances their momentum. I think when you're on a run and you hack somebody, you increase the pressure, and obviously 9 times out of 10, you know, guys are making and missing at the line because it's mental. Now, every now and then, it's no coincidence that very big men have more trouble, because I do think it's like shooting a Nerf ball, more like, you know,
sure,
your hands are too big. Shaq in particular, Will, same way. But I do think mentally it's more than, you know, it's more mental than physical almost all the time. And for Giannis, I think it is. So, yeah, I think that it's I expect what I will say is I expect Phoenix to win game 5. And then I think it probably will go 7 just because I think they're really interesting teams. They each have things they can do and adjust to that can dent and can really take away each other's strengths on occasion. And that's a powerful thing to be able to do. Now, you might argue it's because neither one of them are great teams, which is an argument. I would argue that they both are really solid teams defensively, and with time to prepare, those defensive weapons can blunt things.
I think that's a big part of this, too, is I think both things can be true. I think that these two teams cannot be great, great teams, but also how quality they are as defensive groups makes the opponent look kind of worse,
right?
Because, you know, it's limiting the amount of shots that go in, right? And I think very basically that's kind of how we begin to quantify how good a team is. You know, how elite is your shot making? And, you know, reality of the situation is, you got Giannis in there, you know, taking away that pick and roll, getting that block like he did on DeAndre Ayton. Even Brooke Lopez is super hard to finish through at the rim. We already talked about Drew Holiday. Like, is this Suns team, if they win the championship, going to be, you know, one of the best champions? Whatever? No, I guess not. But it's still impressive that when even in a game last night where they are able to go 33-55 from two. Because that is, you know, that is impressive shot making. It's even more impressive shot making when you're going up against the best defensive team of the last 3 years in the NBA. So honestly, the historical stuff isn't all that interesting to me. I'm a much more like in the moment of what's happening person. That would be a different conversation. Do we want to talk about who I think is going to win the championship next year?
Right. I know. We began to have that conversation the other night.
We did. But I take nothing away from either of these champions. I think either of them winning the championship. I think it's going to be a fascinating series that whichever one of them wins is going to have busted their ass.
Yeah.
You know, to get it. It was, I don't know. This just struck me in the first quarter of the game. It was just really physical, and it was kind of like one of those scrums underneath Milwaukee's hoop, and you know, I think it was one of the times where PJ Tucker like brought in an offensive rebound, and it's like
four people, you know, jumped on him.
Yeah, just right under there, and Tucker finds a way to like rip it out, and it's just this instant second of chaos. and then immediately gets kicked out to Chris Middleton, and Middleton like takes a sidestep dribble, pulls it back behind three, and slowly like knocks down the shot. And I think that's something we forget that is so difficult, that you can play your ass off in basketball, but if you're not able to slow yourself down enough, slow your mind down enough to shoot,
right,
you're not gonna make shots, right? It's like, if the Milwaukee Bucks all play like Thanasis Antetokounmpo, yeah, they're going to be wild and they're going to be ripping the ball up, but their minds are going to be too anxious to be able to knock down a shot. And that's one of...
They're going to be 12 and 62 or whatever it is.
You know. It's one of my favorite things, though, about high-level playoff basketball is the fight, because I think we all love to watch that fight, but also being able to turn the switch off to, you know, metaphorically or, I guess, realistically, take a breath to knock down a shot, like... That's so cool. And seeing guys be able to do that. And to Middleton's credit, I thought he busted his ass last night while also slowing himself down enough to make 40 points in the game.
It was impressive. I wonder, you know, his post-game interviews are always so low-key and, you know, just
that kinda... was so wild last night. He's just...
Yeah, you know, he was talking about Booker. He was making some tough shots. We just had to do things. But that is the way he plays on the court, too. You know, I mean, there really is a correlation between, you know, what has to be done. I think what Middleton is really good at is knowing when his shot is smooth. I mean, he doesn't, you know, he turns down some shots you think he should take and takes some shots you think he should turn down. But he very rarely looks awful on the shots he does take. And I think there must be a reason why he doesn't take the other ones, because I just think he's really in tune with his own mechanics and his accuracy and his mindset when he's on the court.
And not to blow this out of proportion, but the player I think of, what you're describing right there, is Kevin Durant.
Yeah,
I think Kevin Durant is, you know what I mean?
Yep.
Is so in tune with that of his rhythm, right? And sometimes, and Durant does this too, sometimes he tries to force himself into a rhythm. And we've seen Middleton games this year where he knows what that feels like and he's trying to go get it, because he knows if he hits one or two, then he's going to be able to go for 18 in a quarter. I mean, what was that game seven, against Brooklyn? Didn't Middleton have like 20 points in the third quarter or something?
No,
I think he had 18 last night in the third quarter too. I mean,
the dude is a tremendous closer. And what's interesting, the contrast is Booker, who wills himself into being hot. He doesn't know he's hot. He just thinks this is going to be the shot. I mean, you know, you could just see him, you know, just go get it, you know, and it's just as effective. I mean, he's probably got a higher true shooting percentage than Middleton. I don't know. But they both are just really, really good shooters. And they operate, I think, in a different mental zone. And it's kind of fun to see that happen. I think that
can I pivot this?
Huh?
Or can I pivot this to something Timberwolves related?
Yeah.
So again, as I'm watching in these games, and I can't like not somewhat watch basketball games without putting them through a Timberwolves prism in my head. And this proliferation of the mid-range and this needing of guys finding a rhythm and everything we've really been talking about today. With the Wolves, it's kind of a question mark of, not that they don't have players who could do that, but who will be doing that. And a lot of this we're describing.
D'Lo and Ant.
That's what I'm saying.
Those are the two guys. Right. I mean.
And Ant has a little bit of that, whatever we were talking about with the Middleton and KD, finding that rhythm. That's what we saw him first doing against Portland that one time. It's what we saw him do more. I'm kind of forgetting the game specifically. But Ant does that. He does that when his shot's going in, right? Where he's able to kind of find a rhythm, you know, a rhythm in his three-point shot or his mid-range pull, that sort of thing. Other games, like the Phoenix game comes to mind, where Ant dominated with force. But sometimes Ant also dominates with kind of finesse, creating space, getting to his jump shot and scoring in those sort of areas. And then D'Lo as well. I mean, D'Lo's game isn't, this wouldn't have been a ridiculous thing to say 12 18 months ago is D'Lo's game offensively is similar to Devin Booker's.
And I would even say now, I think it's similar to Middleton's in that he wants crunch time to arrive. I mean, D'Lo has a different D'Lo. I mean, and now I'm going to,
I like that.
Now I'm going to besmirch him by saying he reminds me of Wiggins in the sense that Wiggins waited for crunch time to really be super aggressive with his shots, especially in the first few years when there was a question of who should be the crunch time scorer. If you remember, you know, during Wiggins' first 4 or 5 years, which happened to be Cat's first 3 or 4 years, and one of those years maybe even had Butler enter the picture, Wiggins thought he should be the crunch time guy and acted like it on the court when it was crunch time. And
remember when Sam Mitchell talked about that? Do you ever that on NBA TV? Do you remember that clip? I remember I actually wrote an article about it. I like tweeted out the clip, and Sam Mitchell was like, Andrew Wiggins thinks he's better than Jimmy Butler because look at the two times when we played Chicago,
right?
The year before, and you know, and we beat them both times, and Wiggins outscored Jimmy both of those times. And it's sometimes we forget that that is the psychology
it gets
a lot of times.
Personal, right.
Yeah.
And that's a good point. I think D'Lo strikes me as a person whose self-image is when it's time to close the game out, that's my role, you know? And to his credit, the guy can get his shot off. Very, very rarely does D'Lo get a shot blocked because his release point is so high, his arms are so long, and his judgment on when to go up, his ball fakes. He's somebody... I'm not saying he's going to make all those shots. I don't know what his accuracy is. I know he's run hot and cold. He's lost games for the Wolves and won games for the Wolves with his late game shot making and missing. But I do think that he will be one of those people, if the Wolves ever get good, who thinks, all right, you know, finally, you know, year, whatever, this is my time. And if Ant is on, you know, the career arc that we expect he's on, then I think it's going to be a fascinating, you know, corollary. It's, you know.
But again, this goes back to these two teams, right? It's not just one guy.
Right.
But it isn't
on the other hand, it isn't just one guy. But if Middleton or Booker is not getting the ball when it matters for a make or miss win, there will be questions asked. I mean, that's the thing. And I wonder if it's D'Lo or Ant.
But not
I
if
mean,
it's Chris Paul taking it.
Yeah, I think even so. Unless it's a classic. If it's a classic.
If it's Drew Holiday taking it, then maybe.
But I mean, also, if it's a classic Chris Paul move, if Chris Paul can, you know, do the whole double feint and try a 15-foot fadeaway, if Chris Paul gets his shot, then you could say, no, not it won't be Booker. But if Chris Paul is driving the lane, has to pull up and shoot an awkward off-balance shot from a place that's not his spot, then you go, why didn't you get the ball to Booker? If Booker does the same thing, you don't say, why didn't you get the ball to Chris Paul? You know, right. I do think that there are pecking orders in crunch time. And I think that Middleton clearly has it for Milwaukee. And Giannis doesn't mind that. I mean, Giannis is
it just makes sense.
He's one of those cool superstars that is willing to, you know, be part of the group. And I know that doesn't fit in with the whole Shaq Barkley bullshit, but there are ways to be a generous alpha on your team.
What's interesting is I think a lot of people would hear you saying that and say that's not Cat, right? Cat would want, you know, he would want the ball. He would want these things. But if we look at how it's played off over Cat's career, right? Cat has been a generous superstar. He hasn't been the guy taking those shots late in the games. And a lot of times, you know, people wanted to point at Tibbs for that or Saunders or whoever. But really, Cat has been more like Giannis in that. Not that he can't take a shot late. I mean, we've seen Giannis create late. We've seen Cat create late.
Right.
But Cat has not been – he's never been demanding.
Right.
I was going to say he's never been demanding in the last 2 minutes. He's never really been demanding, period. I would like to see him be more demanding. Chris Finch said that to us a bunch of times. I would like to see Cat be more demanding, you know?
And if you remember the home opener last year, or actually the opener,
Detroit, yeah.
His dimes, he mixed in. It was a beautiful mixture of made trays, dimes to his teammates, you know, the right hockey assist pass. I think I can get excited about Cat being like a superior role player, which is weird to say because he happens to be one of the greatest, most accurate shooters in NBA history. But for all kinds of reasons that have been gone into ad infinitum, you know, bigs trying to create their own shot are easier to defend than really athletic wings trying to create their own shot, or really long arm guys like D'Lo trying to create their own shot. So,
and I would like to find more ways to involve Cat, coaching wise, involve Cat in late game situations as well. I mean, I know you said pecking order is really important. I agree with that as well. But if it is the Wolves next season,
right,
and there is, you know, we're talking under a minute left on the clock, I don't want them to be dogmatic in what they are doing. I think about that Oklahoma City game where it was just Nas setting a pick and roll for D'Lo every time, and it was that over and over and over, right. Ant isn't getting a touch, and he's in the he's in the corner. And I think, objectively speaking, the best play you could have ran if you were the Timberwolves was a high screen Nas Reed for D'Angelo Russell and letting D'Lo create, look for his shot drive. And if you go through it, D'Lo actually made a good amount of those shots there. But there is a rhythm to basketball. There is a need to involve your second best player if you want to win in crunch time. You want to win in the fourth quarter, and Ant didn't touch the ball for 6 minutes.
And I would agree with all that. What I will say is it depends on what the stakes are. If the stakes are all or nothing, and you don't rely on your go-to guy and you miss the shot, you are going to get second guessed. And I am.
I just don't love the process of logic there.
I have been in your camp for a long time, and I'm starting to move away from it for precisely the reasons we talked about at the beginning of this thing. If you have a guy that can get a bucket and in the face of enormous pressure, last night proved it to me. Give me a contested Devin Booker shot over a wide open Cam Johnson shot. And Cam Johnson has been money from wide open. I mean, if you get Cam Johnson an open corner three, I think it's been very, very successful for the Suns. But if it's going to be the season or not, or that game or not, I think I'd still rather go with Booker, because Booker, that's his deal, you know. And Cam Johnson, maybe he'll make it. And Connaughton's kind of the same way. Guys that, you know, are wonderful role players.
But yeah, okay. So this is an age-old question, and I hear what you're saying, but I could list off for you Chicago Bulls alone an example of those Cam Johnsons,
Paxton.
John Paxson,
right.
Steve Kerr, right. Those sort of things. And I think it's actually interesting with Cam Johnson and Pat Connaughton specifically, because they have gotten late game touches. They have gotten critical touches in those games. And Cam Johnson, being the pure shooter he is, he's a guy who grew up being an offensive player his whole life.
Right.
Right?
Right.
He's taken those type of shots.
Yep.
And I don't mean this to be slanderous on Pat Connaughton, but if you watch Pat Connaughton at Notre Dame, he's always been this role player guy, two-way, thinking about involving other sort of people. I doubt Pat Connaughton's ever been a give me the ball late in the game and I'm going to be the one who makes the shot. And how you see that show up now is, you remember where Connaughton had late in the game, minute or two left in the game, he caught it kind of like at the nail going towards the basket. And really, he had the opportunity to go up and try and finish it, but he tried to drop it off. He tried to drop it off to, it was either, well, it wouldn't have been Portis. It might've been Giannis, might've been
somebody
else right under the hoop. And Crowder anticipated that and took it away.
And that's right? That was that big scrum where I think Chris Paul might have been riding somebody down to the ground. I think on that play,
could have been. It's just
right.
I have that's a very long way of me saying I have no problem with the guy who's not number one in the pecking order taking the shot, provided you know that that player has high level offensive confidence. And to the Wolves' perspective, they have those guys.
To be fair to Connaughton, too, Giannis found him in the corner. That was a key shot in the in crunch time. You know, so again,
At the end of the day, what we're saying is
it's a smart play if it works. It's a dumb play if it doesn't, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, that really – remember LeBron, you know, the narrative on LeBron, which was kind of like a retread on the constant narrative that
KG.
Garnett got
– Yeah, right.
They used to slam Garnett for feeding his teammates. You know, he lost seven straight first-round playoff series, and he didn't change, you know? But when it was game six – and he was in on his way to go to the conference finals, he got 38 points of his team's like 83 against Sacramento. So, you know, it's a great argument, a great debate. Obviously, star players, what a shock. Shaq and Barkley and those guys think that stars should hog the ball. You know, why do they think that? You know, because they hog the ball constantly, you know. I look forward to the day that, you know, Grant Hill and LeBron or somebody are asked, you know, should that guy be, you know, trying to take over the game right now? Because it's a different deal. In fact, it pains me. There's so much redundancy between Shaq and Barkley. I mean, Shaq is just like an impoverished man's Barkley. You know, there's absolutely no reason for him to be on that set aside from some, you know, ridiculous foil for bad comedy, you know. Anyway, I don't know how I wound up in that cul-de-sac, but I'm glad I got my.
I can't pull you out. You got to get reversed.
I don't think this is the first time I've said that show sucks, so we'll just leave it at that.
I like it. I can't stand the ESPN one.
Oh, interesting.
I've actually during the finals,
Jay Williams is really bothersome. He's trying to be terse and smart, and all he is he sounds like.
I've just got to the point there's so many places now for great NBA analysis.
Right.
There just is, you know, whether that be.
But it's about personalities. It's not about the quality of what they say. It's how they say it and what the repartee. It's about the trimmings, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's just not, you know, that's not for me when the TV analysis,
right?
That, you know, that isn't for me. What is for me on TV, and I'll sit down, I'll watch the halftime show if it's
right.
Shaq, Kenny, and Barkley, because I know I'm literally just here for entertainment in the same way I would turn
Kenny,
on.
Kenny tries his best. I mean, it used to be Ernie Johnson did too, but then he got a little bit of celebrity because of his illness, and he's been insufferable ever since.
Really? I don't know about that.
Yeah.
It's just interesting because there's different people who like different things. Right. I really like Van Gundy during games. I think he's so good at like calling out things in the moment of that, you know, that I can't pick up on immediately. I might pick up on watching it back or something.
Right.
But he's got that coaching eye where he's able to.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, he's able to grab it right away.
Plus Mark Jackson makes him look good.
But I know, you know, I know other people. I think Doris Burke is that way too.
She's great. And Doug Collins used to anticipate stuff. I love people who dare to anticipate something going to happen.
Yeah, Van Gundy had that last. There's like that weird jump ball. He's like, well, he's going to tip it to Portis right here. Portis is going to see it, and of course, you know, it goes.
Portis didn't see it, and somebody knocked it out of bounds.
Yeah. It's funny. It's not one way to skin a cat, you know, in NBA media. And that's why it's cool. There's a bunch of different people.
So what do you think coming up? I've given you that the Phoenix will win game five. Giannis will try his best to go off sometime. And the success of that will be important. There will be a hack of Giannis. And I'll add further that I think it goes seven.
The one big question mark I have right now is what's going on with Chris Paul's handle.
Mm-hmm.
And is that a product of Drew Holiday? Like we were giving Drew Holiday credit for. And last night particularly looked to me like what round one looked like once Chris Paul came back after that weird shoulder nerve damage thing.
Yeah.
Where that was so bizarre where he couldn't dribble the ball. Like his, seemed like his mind wasn't able to put his arm in the place where the ball was going to be.
And
I don't think it was all the way there. I think that last play where Paul kind of lost it was a little bit of him trying to flop and not really having confidence in that moment.
That was a weird, I think he slipped, to be honest with you. I think he slipped on the floor. There was a few slips last night. Cam Johnson did slip and tried to pretend it was a foul. I mean, I think some people just slip.
Yeah, but I mean, Chris Paul slipped a lot in that game, mentally, I think, or something. Right. I don't know. That's what I'm saying. I don't know what that is.
There was one play he made also where he did like a back pass, which is a classic thing he does, only it was right to Giannis. I mean, that made no sense at all.
Yeah.
I mean, that's so un-Chris Paul-like. That's, you know, that's what a scrub does.
Well, in the Clippers series, I mean, yeah, Chris Paul had that one big, like, 41-point game or something, but the most profound Chris Paul stat I thought from that was that he had, like, 6 total turnovers in the whole series.
Something
insane like that. And again, as we're talking about this possession game, as we talked about earlier, with Phoenix is not going to be on the offensive rebounds at all outside of Ayton, so you're not going to create extra possessions that way, where Milwaukee is going to create extra possessions with their offensive rebounding. And just in general, they're so big and long, they play the passing lanes phenomenally. You just have this discrepancy baked in on personnel alone that Milwaukee's going to get more possessions per game. So can Chris Paul counter that and balance that out by not turning the ball over, by delivering clean passes, getting good looks for his guys to be able to score? Because I think if you do even out that possession battle,
Phoenix is the more efficient team, right?
Yes, and maybe demonstrably so, but that's a question mark. I think we talked about this right after game one, where as soon as Saric went out, you know, you kind of did the simple math and you go, well, who's going to be backup?
Right.
Yeah. Who's going to be backup center at all? And it wasn't really a concern at the time, and it wasn't getting hammered on, because the next two games, or at least the next game, Ayton looked awesome again. Ayton hadn't been in foul trouble at all.
And they do have a small lineup now that is an interesting change of pace. I mean,
it's kind of like the one they went with yesterday to start the second quarter. It's a little Clippers-y. I brought it down here somewhere.
I agree.
They're very big.
Small lineup, right.
Torrey Craig, Jay Crowder, Cam Johnson, and Bridges are out there with
four
Chris
power
Paul.
Forwards, right?
They're four power forward, you know, which is a little Clippers-y.
Four fours and an ace.
And then they eventually, you know, then they bring Ayton back in. So I feel like they can survive with that. The interesting part is the reason they went with that lineup is because Booker was kind of in foul trouble there. If you just go with three of the power forwards and then Booker and Paul, now you're pretty small. If you have all four of the power forwards out there, I think you're big enough to scrap with Giannis. You're big enough to foul him a little bit. You're big enough to get the, you know, the defensive rebounds that you need. But with Booker and Paul in, who you obviously need in, now you're sacrificing size down the ladder a little bit more, which is a tough
balance. And what was interesting was that Bud stuck with his bigs. He had both Lopez and Giannis out there, I think, for some of that time. And both sides got what they wanted in some ways. I mean, it was an interesting tussle.
It was kind of like that Mavs-Clippers series where Carlisle was just like, yeah, we're going with Boban and Kristaps the whole time.
That was wonderful,
I love that.
Right. 15 feet of front court. 15 feet. They were both almost 7.5 feet tall.
But nobody budged. The Mavs stayed big, and they stayed big even when they took those guys out. Was it Cauley-Stein and Powell, I think, were the two guys who came afterwards. And the Clippers were like, well, we're staying small. And it kind of feels like that.
It is fun. I mean, it's like this.
It's a prove it.
You're waiting to see. And what's great is that both sides get their licks in to some extent. I think in that particular case, as much as I love that lineup, you know, having Porzingis be stuck on the perimeter, I regard him, when he was with the Knicks, he was the best.
You loved him.
He was the best rim protector in the NBA. And I know he's been diminished by injury some since then. But if you have that guy, you know, running the paint you know, just basically making sure nobody gets to shoot. That's where he belongs. And he's devalued now. I mean, somebody should pick him up and just make him a shot blocker. You know, I know he can make the threes, but just have him, hey, your identity is a defensive identity, pal. You go down there and you just make sure nobody gets to shoot whenever they set foot inside the paint.
I think there's some concerns that he can physically still do that.
I know. But I would like to see it. And maybe, you know, maybe it's been proven. I don't know. I mean, Carlisle is not stupid. So, but the Boban Kristaps thing, that was interesting. Oh,
loved it.
Boban can't jump.
Porzingis.
Boban can't jump. What I love about Boban is, you know, he shoots the ball and he misses, and everybody goes up for the rebound, and Boban just stands there and grabs it. I mean, it's comical, you know.
It's the kid in fifth grade who's already hit puberty.
Shades of George Mirazon, you know. I mean, he used to do that stuff.
Are you thinking at all, like, I mean, about this off season, just like not Timberwolves specific, but it's really right around the corner. If we go to game 7 in this, it's July 22nd is when that happens.
And the draft is the 28th, is it?
29th, and then free agency opens up on August 6th, 1st. I think. Or I don't think it's
I think it might be August 1st.
Yeah, beginning of August. So, something like summer league's on the 8th.
I remember being shocked. I looked it up and it said August 1st. I went, holy shit. I mean, you know, it's like 3 days after the draft and, you know, right before summer league. And, you know, here we go.
We're going to be doing some – Britt's going to come to summer league.
First time.
There we go. I love it. I convinced him. I think we'll be probably talking about –
First time in Vegas
about,
anyway. I did it with the Los Angeles summer league 1 year. Got hammered with George Carl. Oh, man. That was a wild time. But I was doing a story for Sport Magazine on the Cleveland Cavaliers and Tom Nosalke.
What a name of a magazine.
Sport Magazine. It was, back in the day, it was like probably as well known or better known than Sports Illustrated. And anyway, Tom Nosalke was the coach. Ted Stepien was the owner. It was a dysfunctional
organization. The Stepien rule.
Yeah, Stepien rule hadn't been instituted yet, I don't think. But they were terrible. and George Karl, I think, was angling to replace Nosalke as head coach at some point during that season. And if memory is correct, I think he did at some point in time. So the shenanigans were in the mix. Not that I cared. I was writing a one-off story, but I arrived there on almost no sleep, Los Angeles Summer League, and wound up going to a bar with George Carl. And man, we just, you know, got really drunk and said a lot of things that he said were going to be off the record. And I said, fine. And I don't remember them
now. Did you ever remember?
But they were incendiary and they were probably against Tom Nosalke. But it was my baptism. No doubt about it. I mean, I was like,
this is going to be you and Chris
like 35
in a couple
years
weeks.
Old. I was like almost, you know, just slightly older than you. That's how far along ago it was. But it was.
I can't wait to get hammered with Chris Finch.
Yeah. that would be interesting.
So I think we'll have off season to talk about there as well. On top of, I mean, it's a really Vegas is great for that, and there's just kind of a lot going on. I remember. Yeah. Jace and I were the last summer league I was at. We're there. The Wolves played, and then we stayed afterwards because Zion was making his debut.
Right.
And no joke, an earthquake happens, and I'm sitting next to Jace. Not be it, we're from Minnesota, Wisconsin, right. and like I don't know what's happening right now. And the speakers are swinging up above.
And this
the
is
thing.
In Vegas. I didn't know this Vegas is susceptible to earthquakes.
It was like a shock from
I'm
California.
I'm worried about
or
fires,
something.
Man. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Anyways, so I remember this night very clearly. One, first time ever watching Zion in person. It was incredible. It was shortly
after. Is that when he
after.
Blew his sneaker out?
No, that was at Duke. But he just at one point in the game. literally Kevin Knox had the ball and Zion, I think Kevin Knox got a defensive rebound. Zion's right there and he just puts both of his clamps on it, rips it away from Kevin Knox. Kevin Knox falls over without being touched, just like, you know, it's a tug of war. He loses.
Probably both feet off the ground.
Zion gets up and just crams it. And then in my head, this is inaccurate, an earthquake immediately happens. It didn't immediately happen, but that happened. But no, Jason and I, we went to the SB Nation, like they have like a house there or whatever. And it was the first night of the off season. Like it had just started. And, you know, so it's me and Jason, a bunch of bloggers from across you know, different teams. And it was just the perfect group of people to be with when the news out of nowhere went down that Kawhi Leonard was going to the Clippers. And then a minute later, Paul George was traded there. You know, we're all just in Vegas drinking and you're like, oh my, Kawhi, Paul George. Like, right. And then of course we crowned them the champions for the next 2 years. They haven't even, they haven't even gone anywhere, but,
yep.
But it's,
let that be a lesson to your Brooklyn Net fandom.
Yeah. It's not fandom. They got three. But I'm excited you're coming. I'm excited. I think this off season is going to present out of nowhere moves. Maybe not a ton of them. Maybe not a ton of moves. But
you know, almost every year it does though. The NBA has become an out of nowhere league because people see openings. You know, and let's face it, people's patience. They're not slow building teams anymore. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. that isn't the way it works because stars are restless. And so, right. you know, you appease your stars or you start to rebuild, you know.
And the proliferation of the sign and trade opens up so many more possibilities. I mean, even just, you know, 5 years ago, the right. discourse about where, you know, what activity is going to happen in the offseason was almost completely predicated on who are the top name players who are free agents going into this summer.
Right.
And that's where kind of the moves came from. Now we've seen it time and again with these sign in trades where it's, I guess sometimes the guys are free agents, you know, a Jimmy Butler going to Miami, but then that has this ripple effect of,
right.
you know, Josh Richardson going to Philadelphia back that way. Or, I mean, hell, the Wolves is a great example. Kevin Durant was a sign and trade from Golden State to Brooklyn, and then the baggage that went back Brooklyn's way was D'Angelo, or went back Golden State's way was D'Angelo Russell. You know, so that's what I guess is.
So we wound up getting the dead eye shooter from
Brooklyn. Anyways, that's what I'm talking about. It's kind of like those second wrinkles of it that are pretty, you know, profoundly important. Kemba Walker going to Boston and Terry Rozier going back to Charlotte. I know that doesn't sound like, but it's the stuff where you're like, what?
Right.
You know?
No, I agree.
And I think we'll have, you know, some more of that this year. Obviously Gerson Rosas has talked a big game about that being something that the Wolves want to be in on.
And you have the Simmons factor. There is no way in my view that he goes back to Philadelphia, not after everything that's gone down, you know? So I think he's gone. Mm-hmm. And then the question becomes, do both Griffin and Presti hoard the draft picks? Or does one of them go,
great point.
Does one of them go, hey, this is the time for me to pounce. I'm losing 80% of my draft picks and getting two stars, you know? One of them, I wouldn't even say that.
What I would do, in particular, if I was Presti, is as soon as, like, not even a Simmons level, but like a 24-year-old becomes made available somehow, a Caris LeVert, you know, like, I'm seriously, but like that type of like level of player, those are the guys out. Because if you're Presti, you know, you could whip out your wallet and buy, you know, a couple of hundreds and get a player like that and still be pretty stocked up.
Right.
Same thing if you're Griffin. And I think the idea more so is that New Orleans will do that, will be more quick to do that than Oklahoma City will. And I guess, you know, logically that checks out kind of where New Orleans is. But it's an interesting like alternative path to me if I'm Sam Presti in Oklahoma City of like, well, let's avoid the possibility that this treasure trove ends up kind of turning into what ended up
with the Celtics Boston. And Danny Ainge.
That is
the cautionary tale. I mean, aside from the Fultz Tatum thing, they really did nothing with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because ultimately, like these first round picks, particularly when they are lottery protected, and I don't like when people say, "Oh, you know, late first round picks don't have any value," or when it's out of the lottery, you know, they do.
If you draft well, they do. Right.
Exactly. But so it's just because we can list off some Grant Williams and some James Youngs and some stuff like that doesn't take away from the fact that. Look, Jaden McDaniels last year, right?
Right.
Sadiq Bey, right?
Like, well, not only that, but Presti is a good drafter. Regardless of where he drafts, he gets mm-hmm. people. I mean, Lou Dort, for God's sake, I don't know if he was even drafted, to be honest.
He wasn't
with,
drafted.
They
Pokuševski.
Yeah.
Pokuševski, everybody's.
You can't shamelessly include him now, is it?
No, I don't agree with that
so much.
I am not agreeing with it, but that's what you're talking about. Right. It's targeting
buried guys, you know, guys who are like mm-hmm. 13 years old who are playing in Switzerland, you know.
Well, and there's some of those.
Right.
This draft has a couple of those dudes kind of in the might be just out of the lottery type of players or late lottery, like this Josh Giddey dude who's actually playing on the Australia national team right now has, you know, I was watching him play the other day. Against Nigeria and it's like, yeah, that just totally seems like a guy that Sam Presti would, right. He's been scouting for 4 years and he, you know, wants to bring in with the 16th pick or something like that. So it's.
And what about Griffith? I mean, he's got more in the tank on his roster than Presti does on purpose. And he's also got a ton of picks. So, you know, I can see him leveraging, you know,
well, Lonzo Ball sign and trade. I think that happens for sure. How are you able to finagle that? Like,
right.
Can part of
a greater package, you know, like throwing in a couple of, you know, maybe a number one and a number, you know, and a second rounder from one of his years. And then, and maybe being able to punt Steven Adams somehow. Is Adams done or has he got another year?
No, Griffin signed Adams to an extension last year.
Oh,
I think he has three more years. Yeah.
Yeah, see, he'll have to attach one of those picks to get rid of that.
Could be.
And Presti will probably take it. Come back to OKC.
Come back. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. That would be insane.
Because Presti's got the salary to keep it, and Adams may be fine there, you know? They may find
And is Kemba, SGA like, where does Kemba go?
Right, right.
Like Kemba will probably be
moved. I'm not a Kemba
again.
Fan. I think you're right. I think Kemba they should have moved.
Don't you totally see him on the Lakers or like the Clippers next year?
Oh, I hope not the Clippers. I can see him more on the Lakers than the Clippers. But yeah,
Schroeder back to OKC.
Yeah, they bring the old guys back and then throw in seven draft picks. You know, but yeah, it's going to be interesting. Now, when it comes to Simmons, I think at the end of the day he'll wind up in Portland. I really do. It just makes too much sense. You know,
interesting.
Because they have to keep Dame. And what guy really complements Dame's game?
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And they have McConnell, you know?
You always mess his name up. McCollum.
Oh, all right. Well, and didn't I just call David Griffin Griffith for a while? So you tried to politely correct me?
I just threw it out there.
People know me by now.
You know what you were actually right about is when you said Winston Garland, you're like, oh, he's probably Darius Garland's father. He is.
And there you go. See?
I did.
Yeah, so anything. Trust me on anything before 1985, my friend.
Anything pre-George Karl.
There you go. Yeah, that meeting wrecked my brain.
Sure, it was just that. It's just that.
Right.
Oh, all right, Britt. Well, let's see what happens in these next few games. I think we'll be able to, when will game 7 be? If that's the 22nd, that'll be next Thursday. So we'll definitely talk before that, but I'm with you. I guess your question from 25 minutes ago, do I think this is going the distance? And yeah, I mean, it seems like it. I would struggle to see, I mean, because even if Milwaukee somehow wins this game 5, I just feel like I know it would be back in Milwaukee for game six, but it's hard for me to see either of these teams winning the next two games. Mm-hmm. If I had to pick one team to win the next two games, it would be Phoenix, though.
Me too. But the Suns are in a doubt zone right now. How that works, you know, Aiden and Paul have to both obviously return to form. And
if that's just mental, then I'm.
Yeah, no, I agree. And also, I mean, I would argue that discipline is going to be really important. I think that, you know, as wonderful and as proper as your praise of him was, you know, Holiday has to stop shooting, you know. Mm-hmm. And he has to, if he's going to shoot, he needs much better shot selection. And I would argue that Campaign, who as well as he's played, would do well to not quite try to be so ball hoggish and just try to, you know, more dimes, less acrobatics. Some guys just need to be more disciplined, I guess is what I'm saying. And I think that's important too. Role players knowing their roles, I think is important. But you're right. I mean, I think it's probably going to go seven. If you put a gun to my head, I would pick Phoenix to win it all. But I do think it's going to go seven, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun. That, by the way, can we agree that game four was by far the best of the four games thus far?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I mean, it was so entertaining. I mean, it made you realize that the first three games really weren't as much fun as, you know, you wanted them to be, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it had the very basic element of two guys going at it back and forth.
And controversy. I mean, the refs were so bad and stars who, you know, suddenly weren't playing like stars, you know? So, yeah, interesting.
It was. All right. Well, he's Britt Robson. I'm Dane Moore. Britt and I will be back to talk again next week, and I will be back tomorrow with another film review with Will DeBerg on three more of the draft prospects. Until then, he's Britt, I'm Dane. Peace out. How I'm feeling, man, I hope it never stop, yeah. Green and hot so you can find me in the crowd, yeah, yeah. Don't let standards ever bring you down, yeah.